so, I'll pick you up at about 1:30. That should give us plenty of time.
Yes, and remember, the bet still stands, eh? Chelsea, they win by 2 clear goals. We go up west and the loser pays... Ah, Lyle?
Eh?
That's funny.
What?
It's a Kenton's door. Well, it's wide open, but there's no lard on.
Well, close it for them.
No, there might be something wrong. Burglary or something. I'll give them a shot. Mr. Kenton! Mr. Kenton!
Doesn't seem to be in.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have a look. It's so unlike them with all the stuff in the shop. Jack, see if there's a light switch by the door.
No.
Great Scott! Look at this!
All that blood. Who is it?
Oh, it's Mrs. Kenton. She must have fallen down the stairs in the dark. Her husband must be out. Hey, look, I'll stay here and you go and see if you can find a copper. Or use the phone box at the corner of Sydney Street and ring 999.
Can't we do anything for her?
No, we mustn't move her. Anyway, it's too late. I'm sure she's dead.
It's time for you to take your place on the jury as Bristol Myers, makers of New Ban Roll-On and New Ban Aerosol Spray Deodorant, Clairol Hair Care Products, and Ipana Toothpaste, invite you to... Consider your verdict.
If you're a woman who colors her hair, here's important news.
Exclusively formulated Clairol shampoo is now available throughout South Africa. Every woman who colors her hair needs new Clairol shampoo when she washes her hair. Clairol shampoo won't harm hair coloring, won't fade the shade, wash after wash.
Don't wash the life out of your hair coloring. Use new Clairol shampoo for color-treated hair. And now Clairol shampoo is available everywhere throughout South Africa.
Has a little of the magic gone out of your life lately? Maybe your gray hair keeps you from looking as exciting as you still are. Hate that gray? Wash it away with Loving Care by Clairol. Loving Care washes away gray without changing your natural hair color. There are 11 beautiful shades of Loving Care. Choose the one nearest to your natural hair color. Wash years away in minutes with Loving Care.
The charge against Roger Kenton is that on the evening of Friday, March the 17th, 1967, he had caused the death of his wife, Isabel Kenton, by hitting her on the back of the skull with a blunt instrument, causing her to fall down a flight of stairs, and then leaving her to die of the injuries sustained. Kenton, who is 50 years of age, has since his discharge from the army attempted to earn a livelihood in a variety of ways. From selling goods on commission to managing a small restaurant, all with varying degrees of failure, until some 3 years ago, when his wife, whom he married in 1951, provided the money for him to set up as an antique dealer in a small way in Chester Street, Chelsea. Even this venture appeared to be no more successful than his previous endeavors, probably due to Kenton's sketchy knowledge of the antique trade. Although he himself puts the cause of his wife's reluctance to lay out sufficient capital for him to enlarge the business and to compete with more established dealers. The Kentons lived above the shop, access to the living quarters being obtained by a flight of stairs leading from a door in Chester Street next to that of the shop. On the night in question, Inspector Roxbury was called to the building as a result of a telephone call made to Scotland Yard. I call as my first witness Inspector Roxbury. Inspector Roxbury, will you please describe the sequence of events subsequent to your arrival at Chester Street?
Yes, sir. I found Mrs. Kenton lying at the foot of the stairs leading from the street door. She was quite dead and appeared to have lost a considerable quantity of blood from a head wound and the base of the skull. She was dressed in her night clothes and From the state of the bed when I examined the house, it would appear that she had at some time previously actually been in bed. There was no one else in the building and no obvious signs of burglary. The front door had not been forced, and although there were several windows in the upper floor open, there was no evidence that the entry had been made through any of them. After taking a statement from the two young men who had discovered the body, I sent them home and waited for the arrival of Mr. Kenton. He arrived at some 10 minutes after 11.
What on earth's going on here?
Excuse me, sir. Are you Mr. Kenton?
Yes, but what's going on? Has there been a burglary?
I'm afraid it's rather more serious than that, sir.
Isabel. It's Isabel. Something's happened to my wife.
Yes, sir.
Immediately suggested that there'd been a burglary and then surmised that his wife was involved.
Yes, sir. We went upstairs into the living room and I explained what we had found. He listened quite calmly but kept looking over to the sideboard. Are you looking for something, Mr. Kempton? Is there anything missing?
The cash box. They must have taken the cash box. I left it there before I went out.
Was there much in it?
Oh, some 30 or 35 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
We kept the cash up here. There's a small safe in the shop. But we always thought that that was the obvious thing for them to take if there was a burglary. So I only kept some files and odd papers in it and brought the cash up here with me every night when I closed up. Someone must have known about that.
Possibly, sir. Can you explain your movements this evening to me?
Certainly. I've been to the cinema, the Granada. It was a Western I particularly wanted to see. I'm an addict as far as Westerns go. My wife didn't care for them much, so she decided to stay at home and go to bed early.
And what time did you go to the cinema?
Shortly after 7. I was a bit early for the start of the last program, so after I bought my ticket, I hung about in the foyer for a while until it was time to go in. Just as I was going to my seat, I met a friend, George Andrews. We arranged to have a quick drink afterwards.
You didn't sit with him?
No, he was with his wife and another couple. But as I said, we met afterwards.
So, Kenton had an alibi for the entire evening.
Oh, that's how it appeared at the time, sir. Following morning, I interviewed Mr. Andrews, and he confirmed Kenton's statement. They had met again in the foyer after the film ended, and had gone to the public house next door to the cinema, where they had one drink and discussed the film. Although there were accountable fingerprints to be found, and nothing appeared to be missing except the cash box, I was forced to accept the theory that someone had rung the doorbell, calling Mrs. Kenton from her bed. She had answered it, been forced upstairs, and then struck over the head by person or persons unknown, who had then taken the cash box and left the shop, leaving the front door open.
That, indeed, was a theory which would fit the facts as you knew them then. What caused you to change your ideas?
A visit I had from Mr. Armitage, sir, Mrs. Kenton's brother. Sit down, Mr. Armitage. I believe there's something you wanted to tell me.
Yes, Inspector. It's about Isabel's death. I'm sure Kenton had a hand in it.
I must warn you, Mr. Armitage. It's very dangerous to go about making statements like that, and unless you have some valid reason. Oh, I've no doubt you're very upset about your sister's death, but I must advise you that you can only do yourself harm by allowing your feelings to let you make rash statements without proof. I don't see how you can suggest that Mr. Kenton had any connection with the crime when he was sitting in the cinema at the time.
But that's just it. Why would he want to see the film twice in a week?
What's that?
When I spoke to Isabel on Wednesday morning, she told me that Roger had been to the Granada on Tuesday night.
And that was the moment when you began to wonder whether Kenton's alibi was quite as sound as it first appeared.
Yes, sir. Before facing Kenton with this new information, I decided to seek a further interview with Mr. Andrews. He is by profession an insurance agent, and I visited him at the office. I'm sorry to trouble you again, Mr. Andrews, but an investigation like this, well, we've got to be very thorough.
Not at all. In point of fact, if you hadn't come to see me, I would have been in touch with you. You see, I've known Roger Kenton for a number of years, and I handle all his insurance. In relation to the life policies which we have issued, I notified head office of Mrs. Kenton's death, and it was their feeling that I should speak to you.
Why was that?
It's jolly difficult. I know Roger is a bit of a... Well, let's just say that he's been unlucky in the past. But I like him. And I really thought he might settle down and make a go of this antique business.
Mm-hmm.
Right spot, you know.
Yeah, I see.
I'd arranged ordinary insurance cover on the shop, and I also fixed the life policies on himself and Mrs. Kenton. They weren't big. But Roger said that his wife hadn't got much out of him since they'd been married, so she might just as well benefit a little if he died.
No.
Then last Thursday, just before she died, he came in and increased his wife's policy considerably and paid the premium.
Oh, he did he?
That's right. It's one of these policies which can be commuted into a form of annuity at a later date. He said the shop was looking up and that this was one way of seeking a little security for the future.
You said considerably. What, in fact, does this amount to?
Well, at her death, Kenton stands to receive £50,000.
Oh, I see. Now, Mr. Andrews, let us go back to that visit to the cinema. Did you expect to see Mr. Kenton there?
No, but I wasn't surprised. It is the type of film that he likes.
Well, let me ask the question another way. Could he have expected to meet you at the Granada?
I don't think so. No. Wait a minute. Aye, now I come to think of it, he could. When he was here last Thursday, I told him that I was going.
Ah, thank you, Mr. Andrews.
Inspector, you don't think there's something wrong, do you? I mean, I saw him as he went in and then again at the end of the film.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. It's just something I've got to work out. I'd be grateful, by the way, if you didn't mention this conversation to anyone.
You have my word for it.
Think back, if you will, Mr. Andrews, to that meeting at the cinema. Shut your eyes. It sometimes helps to conjure up an image. Can you remember any difference between the appearance of Mr. Kenton before and after the film?
Difference? I don't quite follow. He certainly seemed to be very animated while we were in the pub. He kept on talking about the film. Mind you, it was a good one. But I'm not so devoted to Westerns as Roger is. I just like a well-made film.
His appearance.
I'm thinking. You know, Inspector, you're right. Shutting your eyes, I mean. I can see him as clearly as anything. I've got it. I am sure of it. Before the film, he had a raincoat over his arm, and I can't remember seeing him with it afterwards when we were in the pub.
Kenton had no raincoat with him when he arrived home on the night of the murder. And when I questioned him, he reaffirmed his statement regarding his movements on the night of the murder and denied having visited the Granada on the Tuesday. I then asked permission to remove the clothing he had been wearing on the Friday night. He made no objection to me taking his suit and shoes and the shirt and the underclothing which he had worn had already gone to the laundry.
Then, at a later date, as a result of further investigation into the veracity of his alibi and the report of the police laboratories and the government pathologist, you charged Kenton and took him into custody.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That is all. Inspector,
is it a habit of yours to ask people to shut their eyes and dream dreams?
And not to dream, sir. Sometimes helps to clarify the memory.
Or to see pictures which you are painting?
No, sir.
Let us consider this alleged missing raincoat. When you examined my client's wardrobe, did it contain a raincoat?
Yes, sir. A brand new one. I asked him about it. Oh, I see. You've got a new raincoat, Kenton.
Yes, I bought it a few days ago.
Why?
Oh, really, Inspector, why does one buy a raincoat? Because it's needed.
What happened to the old one?
I don't remember having mentioned an old one. But in fact, I did have one. It was very old. Proofing had perished, and I threw it away.
It had been raining on the Friday afternoon. Why didn't you take your raincoat to the cinema?
It may have been raining in the afternoon, but it wasn't when I went out. And it didn't look as though there would be any further rain.
A perfectly logical explanation, don't you agree, Inspector?
I did check with the Weather Bureau, and there was no rain in the London area on that day after 4:30 in the afternoon.
Mrs. Kenton was struck down with some instrument. Has the Weather Bureau or any other bureau been able to assist your investigation in finding that instrument or even establishing what that instrument was?
Really, my lord?
I apologize. But the body of the question still stands.
We've been unable to find the weapon used, but in the area there are many places where it could have been disposed of.
Was there a poker in the house?
No, sir. There were no open fires in the house, only electric element heaters.
Any iron bars?
No, sir.
So if it was an instrument such as you describe, it was in all probability brought into the house on the night of the murder for the sole purpose of committing the crime.
It is possible, sir. But it could have been there all the time.
During the period between 7 o'clock and the start of the program at the cinema, was Kenton seen in the foyer, swinging a poker or an iron bar in his hand?
No, sir.
Is it likely that he could have secreted a poker in the pocket of his suit?
Of course not, sir. No one ever suggested
that
he might...
Calm me, Inspector. You have to defend your case, but I must defend my client. No further questions.
I feel that this would be a good opportunity for the court to adjourn.
And we take this opportunity to remind you that this dramatic presentation is brought to you by Bristol Myers. The court is once more in session with leading counsel for the Crown rising to call his next witness.
I call Mrs. Sally Green. Mrs. Green, you're employed as an usherette at the Granada Cinema, Chelsea.
That's right.
One of your duties is to open the exit doors at the end of the performance.
Well, if I'm on late, we take in turns, see? Two of us in the stalls have to stay on to the end, and the rest can go as soon as the main film starts.
And you were on late shift on the Friday night in question?
Yes. I always work late on Fridays. My old man goes to the dogs at Wimbledon that night, so there's no point in being off early.
The exit beyond the toilets is operated by what is known as a crush bar.
Yes.
This system of fixing means that the doors are opened by pressing a bar on the inner side, but the door can neither be opened nor properly closed from the outside.
That's right.
On this Friday night, did you find the door already open?
Yes.
So you would assume that someone had already left by that exit?
Yes.
Could this have happened at any time during the performance? Or are the doors checked at regular intervals?
Any time, I suppose. We see that the doors are closed before the show starts, but no one bothers to look at them again until we have to open them.
Thank you. That is all.
Mrs. Green, was there any special reason for you to remember that the door was open?
I was asked by the inspector.
Was this the first time that you'd found the door open?
No. No, it happens now and then. Someone doesn't like the film, goes to the toilet, and, well, that's the nearest door to the street.
Was the cinema full?
Well, Friday night was pretty full. It's a busy night anyway, and there was quite a good program.
You work in the store. Do you know how many seats there are in the stalls?
Ooh, a lot. About 700.
853, to be exact, and most of them were sold. Any one of some 800 people could have got up and gone out of the exit.
I suppose so, but most of them seemed to like the film.
I'm sure they did. No further questions.
I now call Mr. Harold Armitage. Mr. Armitage, you are the brother of the deceased.
Yes, I am.
You made a statement to the police that to the best of your knowledge, the prisoner attended a performance at the Granada Cinema on the Tuesday prior to the death of your sister.
I did.
Had you any reason to suspect that the prisoner might do your sister harm?
Not exactly that, but I knew that there was trouble between them. Isabel came and had lunch with me on Wednesday before the murder. She used to come most Wednesdays. And more coffee, Isabel.
No thanks, Harold. That was very nice.
How's Roger going with the shop?
Oh, that's going the usual way. Anything he touches goes down. He keeps trying to get me to put more money in it. He says that with more capital, he's sure that he'll be able to bid against the big boys and really get known. But the real answer is that he doesn't know enough about it.
You're right, Isabel. I wouldn't let him have another penny. Uncle George would turn in his grave if you didn't take some care of the money he gave you. I said it before and I'll say it again. I cannot understand what you see in Roger.
Perhaps you can't, and I'm not going into all that again. It's been quite a few years now, and if you live with someone for some time, you get used to things. Even his liking for those rubbishy westerns, he loves them. He went to the Granada to see one last night. I just stayed home and read a book.
You're too easy with him. Make him take you out more and enjoy yourself. Put your foot down.
Don't worry, Harold. I'm happy enough. But I tell you one thing. Not another penny does he get from me for the shop. Now, let's change the subject. How's Amy doing at the tech?
So, on oath, you assert that the prisoner had already seen the film he alleges he saw for the first time on the night of the murder, and that there had been money troubles between Kenton and your sister?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Armitage, do you like Roger Kenton?
What?
I asked you a simple question. Do you like your brother-in-law?
Well, I never thought that much of him. I didn't think he was good enough for Isabel.
You didn't like him.
I thought he was a failure.
Successful men do not always make the best husbands. However, at that pass. Mrs. Kenton didn't enjoy Western films.
No, they bored her.
So she would not necessarily pay much attention to where they were showing.
She knew that Roger went to the one at the Granada.
Did she know there was also a Western showing at the Forum?
She didn't mention it. She said the Granada.
But taking so little interest in that kind of film, might not she have assumed it was the one at the Granada?
She said the Granada.
But isn't it possible?
We don't know what is possible, do we? All we do know is that she said the Granada.
No further questions.
I now call Dr. Eustace Freeman. Dr. Freeman, as government pathologist, you were called to examine the body of Mrs. Kenton and also various articles of clothing submitted to you by the police?
Yes.
In words that can be readily understood by this court, will you describe what your examinations revealed?
Mrs. Kenton had received a blow on the base of the skull from a heavy, rounded object, which must have been approximately 1 inch round in diameter. The blow was delivered with considerable force, and a fracture of the skull resulted. Her left forearm had also sustained a multiple fracture, which would be consistent with a fall down a flight of stairs. But neither of these fractures would necessarily of themselves have resulted in her death. The blow on the skull was severe, and in fact, in a state of unconsciousness, she had literally bled to death. With regard to the clothing, apart from the usual suit and general dirt which one would expect to find in clothing worn in London, there was evidence of various polishes and varnishes which were consistent with the wearer being occupied in the antique furniture trade.
But no trace of bloodstain?
On the suit, no. With regard to the shoes, although they'd been well polished and even probably washed at a recent date, traces of blood were found embedded in the joint between the sole and the upper of the left shoe.
Was it possible to identify this blood?
It was human blood of the Group O.
And Mrs. Kenton's blood?
Group O.
Thank you, Dr. Freeman. That is all.
Dr. Freeman, in your profession and in your position as government pathologist, you are most highly esteemed. In fact, there are those who have voiced the opinion that you are infallible.
That would be a foolish opinion. None of us are infallible.
Thank you, sir. You've saved me asking the question. You can sometimes be mistaken.
Obviously, but as infrequently as human error will allow.
You found no signs of blood on the suit.
I've already stated that.
But slight traces on just one of the shoes.
Yes.
Having regard to the manner of the assault, would you not have expected to find more blood on the shoes and at least some signs on the suit?
If the suit and the shoes had been worn at the time of the assault, possibly.
Ah.
But I've never been told as fact that the suit and shoes were worn at the time. And even if the suit had been worn, it might have been protected by some outer covering.
And the shoes?
They'd been cleaned. And traces of blood are much more readily removed from highly polished leather than from a fabric.
The blood found was of Group O. Is this a very common blood group?
Yes.
Would it interest you to know that the prisoner is also of the same group?
It wouldn't interest me in the very least. I've said it's a very common group.
But your evidence would tend to imply that the blood found on the shoe came from Mrs. Kenton.
What you imply from my evidence is of no concern to me. I've been asked to state what I found on examination of various objects, and that is what I've done. The conclusions are for the court to decide.
No one was present except the murderer when Mrs. Kenton was struck down. No witness can step forward and point an accusing finger and say, that man is guilty. But a chain of events has been related that can leave no doubt. Why was this crime committed? Simply for financial gain. We have heard of a loving wife who has for years overlooked the failings in the man she loved. A wife who had nurtured and supported him, who had financed projects in which her faith was doubtful due to the ineptitude of her husband. We have heard how at last she cried a halt until some signs of actual ability and success were shown. This cry of halt was but a spur to the prisoner to take matters into his own hands. Is it possible to believe his explanation of why the life insurance was so suddenly and greatly increased? And as to the commission of the crime, the prisoner at first supplies an alibi which would seem complete. But you have heard how, in fact, it is no alibi at all. there was the means and ample time for him to have left the cinema and returned between his first and second meetings with Mr. Andrews. You have heard how simple it was for him to have discussed the film on that Friday night, for he had already viewed the program on the previous Tuesday. You have heard of the disappearing raincoat. No wonder a new one was purchased and the old one thrown away, when in all probability it was covered in his wife's blood. Blood, which you have heard in the medical evidence, was found on his shoe and could have come from nowhere but from the murdered woman. The chain of events is complete, and nothing remains for you but to point your finger at the prisoner and speak the one word, guilty.
My lord, gentlemen of the jury, you, like myself, must have sat patiently throughout this trial, waiting for the crowd to present one shred of evidence which might justify my client being in the position in which he finds himself today. But all that we've been subjected to is a series of theories and surmises. Possibly, there had been a discussion over money matters, but this is a common occurrence in many families. And of the murder, what vestige of proof has the Crown provided to link it with the accused? A missing raincoat? By an unfortunate coincidence, the new one had been purchased but a few days before the murder. A story that the film had been seen before. It is impossible to remove the doubt that Mrs. Kenton had been mistaken. The evidence of the blood on the shoe? The pathologist himself stated that he drew no conclusions, simply stated what he had found. Kenton's blood is of the same group and could at any time have found its way into the crack from a cut finger. I submit that there is no case to answer.
Well, you have heard all the relevant facts. Would you say that Roger Kenton is guilty or not guilty of the murder of his wife? In a few moments, we'll bring you the verdict recorded in the actual trial upon which this dramatic presentation is based.
Silence in court. Gentlemen of the jury, have you arrived at a true and just verdict?
We have, my lord. We find the prisoner at the bar guilty of murder.